Today is Monday, October 17, 2011. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lumlin, and this is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to all of you on the internet.
Last Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives took up the issue of coal ash. They struck down the EPA's attempt to categorize coal ash as a hazardous material. The bill likely will be considered by the Democrats.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Good evening. It is 5:07 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, we will be having a live discussion with Dr. Chris Erickson, a sessional lecturer here at UBC's Political Science Department. And since we at News 101 are very interested in the Occupy movement, slowly spreading across the world, we'd like to have a well-informed discussion with Dr. Erickson about the ideas fueling the frustrated minds behind this movement.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
A study last year by a coalition of environmental groups found that 100... I'm Nell Abel. SRN headlines. Today in Yemen, government forces and soldiers aligned with a rebel commander clashed in Sana'a as protesters continued to call for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to step down. The violence marks an escalation in the 10-month-long protests and follows a weekend in which government forces fired on street crowds. A video posted on YouTube Sunday shows men carrying a woman who appears to be bleeding from the head after shots ring out in the central city of Taiz. In Sana'a, activists said pro-government snipers on the rooftops opened fire on protests, which killed at least 13, according to Al Jazeera. On Saturday, at least 17 were killed in the capital. The violence follows a U.S. drone strike Friday that killed at least 9 people, including the son of American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki was killed last month in a similar attack in the first known case of the U.S. intentionally killing a U.S. citizen in its war on al-Qaeda. According to Tokyo Electric and Power Company, the amount of radiation emanating from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has dropped by half over the last month. A TEPCO official also said today that they now project that by year's end, the reactors will be at a cold shutdown or below the boiling point. That cold shutdown is one of the prerequisites for allowing local residents to move back into the area. But just a little more than 50 miles away in Odawara, a mountain of radioactive coal ash is piling up at a municipal waste plant. 400 tons of the toxic waste is about to exceed the protected capacity of the trash plant. And in nearby Kashiwa, an incinerator was shut because even though it used a process that makes less toxic ash, that which it does create is highly radioactive. Last Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives took up the issue of coal ash. They struck down the EPA's attempt to categorize coal ash as a hazardous material. The bill likely won't be considered by the Democrat-led Senate. A study last year by a coalition of environmental groups found that 137 coal waste sites in the U.S. have contaminated local groundwater. The Telangana statehood bid in India's Andhra Pradesh is heating up. A general strike was called today after police allegedly beat protesters blockading a railway. Meanwhile, schools and colleges in the region remain closed despite a government ultimatum. FSRN's Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
More than 15,000 private schools have been closed since mid-September as part of the month-long Telangana agitation for a separate state. A group of parents demanding that the schools reopen met with Chief Minister Kiran Reddy Saturday. After that meeting, the state issued an ultimatum to schools, reopen by Monday or lose accreditation. But not one school opened its gate today, fearing a backlash from the agitators. The problem is even more complex for 10th and 12th grade students facing exams. Their courses are incomplete and no one knows when the classes will commence again. Urmila Reddy, a 12th grade student, is worried.
I don't know what will happen to my future. I was planning to study engineering after my final exams in April next year, but due to this agitation, everything seems uncertain.
It is unlikely that the schools will reopen anytime soon. The separatists say that school closure is a small sacrifice needed to achieve a greater goal. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
The U.S. Supreme Court said today that it will hear a case about corporate liability for human rights abuses committed abroad. The matter involves Shell Oil and the Ogoni people of Nigeria, who claim that the oil giant is responsible for Nigeria's violent government suppression of anti-oil protests. The case could have broad implications for other suits pending in lower courts against companies like Chiquita and Exxon. The court also announced that it will not hear a land rights case brought by the Oneida Nation against New York. They say that the state drastically underpaid for their land, but the high court let stand an earlier decision that tossed out their claim. The leader of the landmark Native American fight to force the federal government to account for billions of dollars of missing land trust money has died. Eloise Cobell, for years the treasurer of the Blackfeet Nation, filed a landmark lawsuit against the Interior Department. Lawmakers finally settled the case for $3.4 billion, the largest class action settlement in U.S. government history. Eloise Cobell.
There can never be 121 years that our trustee can get away with never giving an Indian person an accounting of their money.
Cobell died Sunday. She was 65. And the matriarch of Cuba's Ladies in White, Laura Pollan, died Friday after her husband, a journalist, was arrested and jailed by the Fidel Castro regime in 2003. Pollan mobilized the women in the lives of Cuban political prisoners to march every Sunday. Last year, Cuban President Raul Castro agreed to free the last 50 political prisoners. Pollan's husband was among them. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thank you to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. I'll be going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
AMS Connect is a brand new service that offers a variety of ways for you to get connected to your campus, your city, and your world. We provide online listings of local volunteer opportunities and internship placements that allow you to gain valuable job experience and explore your passions outside of the classroom. The Connect office also facilitates volunteer placements abroad. Do stuff, get involved. For more information, call 604-822-9268 or you can go to their website at www.ams.ubc.ca/vex.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM right here in Vancouver. It's now time for your local headlines.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper named two new justices from Ontario to the Supreme Court of Canada on Monday. Justice Andromaque and Andromaque Karata, I'm sorry, that last name is impossible to pronounce, and Justice Michael Moldaver are the government's nominees to fill the two open spots at the country's highest court. Both candidacies were examined through a comprehensive process, according with a statement issued by Harper. It added that they have the skills and qualifications necessary to serve Canadians as judges of the Supreme Court of Canada. The two judges will appear before a parliamentary committee on October 19th to answer questions from MPs as part of the appointment process. Karakatanis and Moldaver both currently sit on the Ontario Court of Appeal. She was appointed to that bench last year, while Moldaver has served on it since 1995.
A national suicide prevention strategy is needed in Canada, a Canadian Medical Association journal article urges. About 10 people die by suicide every day in this country. Despite national guidelines calling for a national strategy to prevent these, Canada doesn't have one. In contrast, many countries in Europe, as well as the United States, New Zealand, and Sri Lanka, have adopted national suicide prevention strategies. In Finland, the rate of suicide decreased 9% from before 1985 when the program was adopted. In an analysis published on Monday's issue, Dr. Paul Links, a psychiatrist at the University of Toronto, concluded that in Canada, the strategy includes encouraging the federal government to form a national strategy for suicide prevention similar to those in place in so many other developed nations.
Vancouver police say it could take up to 2 years to finish laying charges related to the Stanley Cup riots. Investigators have just returned from Indianapolis, where they worked with experts to analyze more than 5,000 hours of video, three times more than the amount they originally thought they had. At a news conference on Monday morning, Inspector Leslie said investigators have identified more than 15,000 criminal acts on the videos, and between 500 and 700 people may be charged by the time the investigations are concluded. So far, nobody has been charged, but police say they are moving slowly to ensure that the maximum number of charges are laid, and promised the first 40 charges will be announced at the end of the month. Inspector Yeo could not estimate the final total cost of the massive investigation, but said that the Vancouver Police Department is in talks with the province for more funding. The riot broke out after the Vancouver Canucks game 7 loss in the Stanley Cup final on June 15th. Rioters spent hours torching cars, smashing windows, and looting stores in the city's downtown core, causing millions of dollars worth of damage.
Only one-third of the units in a major supportive housing initiative between Vancouver and the province have been filled by the homeless, according to an official report from Vancouver mayoral candidate, MPA councillor Susan Anton. 4 facilities have been opened so far, and another 2 scheduled to open by the end of the year. People considered living in the streets or sheltered homeless occupy 144 of the 288 units created so far. Suzanne Anton said the city has spent $60 million in this project, but has only housed a few homeless. Last week, news reports suggested the housing ministry has decreased funding for emergency shelters in Vancouver because more permanent housing was coming online.
Sri Lanka says Canada is falling for terrorist propaganda with its newfound criticism of the Asian country's human rights record and its demand for an international inquiry. Quote, "We want Canada to see the correct situation," end quote, said High Commissioner Chitrangani Wagiswara after Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird has criticized Sri Lanka for blocking international efforts to investigate the conduct of its forces in the final days of its long civil war against the terrorist Tamil Tigers. Human rights organizations estimate tens of thousands of innocent civilians were killed during this long civil war.
Like so many other cities around the world, protesters are in for the long haul at Occupy Vancouver, camping throughout the weekend in front of the Art Gallery Square. As many as 5,000 people took part in the demonstration in Vancouver when it peaked on Saturday, or started on Saturday, rather. It was just one of the many popping up across the globe in solidarity with the original, ongoing Occupy Wall Street in New York. Several hundred people remained on site yesterday afternoon, though the scope of the crowd and activity is expected to surge again in Canadian cities as the work week gets underway. Vancouver police say the demonstrations to date have been peaceful and there have been no major incidents.
European leaders are running out of time to prevent Eurozone debt problems turning into a full-blown global crisis, said Canadian Finance Minister Jim Flaherty on Monday after Germany warned a breakthrough was unlikely at a summit this weekend. Financial markets have risen in the past week on hopes that a firm plan to draw a line under the two-year-old crisis would be struck at a European Union summit on Sunday. But Germany lowered expectations of a breakthrough on Monday. Speaking at an event in Dublin, Mr. Flaherty said that if the crisis was left unaddressed, it would eventually become too big for Europe to solve, and immediate action was therefore needed to stop the crisis from becoming even more costly. Mr. Flaherty said, quote, "The good news is that this crisis can still be contained and reversed if nations summon the determination to do so. The bad news is that this crisis already costs way too much."
Flood threats to Thailand's capital appeared to have eased today, but officials warned the crisis was not over as military and civilian authorities battled the worst inundations in decades. 3 months of heavy monsoon rains have deluged around one of the three provinces in central and northern Thailand, causing floods several meters deep in places and leaving around 300 people dead. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to seek refuge in shelters as rising waters swallowed homes and businesses and shut down industry. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra has asked the country's military to take charge of the emergency response in five of the kingdom's worst-hit provinces, including the low-lying historic city of Ayutthaya, which has been underwater for over a week. The floods have also damaged 10% of Thailand's rice paddy.
Fighters with Libya's interim government have captured the town of Bani Walid, firing their guns into the air and hoisting the country's new flag over the center of one of the final strongholds of Muammar Gaddafi's loyalists. A Reuters team that drove into the heart of Bani Walid, in desert hills 150 kilometers south of Tripoli, saw no signs of resistance from supporters of the deposed leader, who have been holed up inside the town for more than 6 weeks. Quote, "Bani Walid is completely free. It is liberated, 100%, said Mohammad Shakona, a military commander with the National Transitional Council. The apparent capture of Bani Walid brought Libya's new rulers a step closer to being in full control of the vast, oil-producing North African country, almost 2 months after rebels entered Tripoli and ended 42 years of one-man rule by Gaddafi. Along with Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte, Bani Walid was one of Libya's last sources of armed resistance to the NTC.
The Mexican army says it has rescued 61 men who were being held prisoner by a drug gang near the border with the U.S. The captives were found in a house guarded by three suspected kidnappers in the town of Piedras Negras in Coahuila State. They said they had been abducted from various parts of Mexico and forced to work for organized crime. Mexico's drug cartels are frequently accused of kidnapping and of exploiting migrants trying to cross the U.S. border. Troops found the captives during a security sweep in which 6 tons of marijuana were also discovered. They did not say which criminal organization was involved. Several different drug gangs operate in Coahuila State, including the Zetas and Gulf cartels, which have been fighting a bloody battle for control of smuggling routes into the U.S.
Chilean students who are protesting for for-profit education are calling for a general strike. Trade unions have agreed, and a 2 days general strike has been called for on October 18th and the 19th. Both secondary and university students, as well as teachers, have been holding demonstrations and boycotting classes for 5 months now, demanding free education. The present system was introduced during the Pinochet regime. Chile's government claims the movement has been taken over by extremists. If so, they nevertheless have plenty of popular support. Student leader Camila Vallejo blamed the government for the collapse of talks. Quote, "They did not have the political will to meet the demands of the great majority in our country." Chilean President Sebastian Piñera has expressed hope that student leaders will return to negotiations. Although Piñera promised limited reforms and about $4 billion in extra funding, he has rejected calls for full state control and free education for all. These are the largest demonstrations in Chile since the return of democracy.
The Liberian-flagged Rena has been stuck for 12 days on a reef 14 miles off Tauranga on the east coast of New Zealand's North Island, having already spilled about 350 tons of toxic fuel and some of its hundreds of containers into the sea. Salvage teams were adding extra pumps to speed up the recovery of the oil, as thick as peanut butter, from the 236-meter, or 775-foot, vessel through holes in the side of the to a barge. More than 70 tons have been recovered, but fears are that bad weather will halt the operation and possibly send the stern section, which contains more than 1,000 tons of oil, tumbling into 60 meters of water.
Violence that broke out at what began as a peaceful protest in Rome against economic inequality is a worrying signal for civil society. The rioters will be identified and punished, said Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. About 100 people were taken to hospital for injuries suffered in Saturday's violence in the Italian capital. Police arrested about 20 people, but that number is expected to rise as investigators examine surveillance cameras. Thousands turned up to protest in Rome, one of hundreds of cities across the globe where activists held protests inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement. But the peaceful march was quickly hijacked by hundreds of hooded and masked protesters who hurled rocks, and bottles at the police. There's a lot of discontent in Italy over the government's failure to deal with the country's economic crisis and high unemployment as well. Students complain they have no future, while Italy has the second highest debt burden in Europe after Greece.
Those are your international, national, and local headlines right here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building on campus at UBC. Coming up next, your weekday weather forecast with the Storm Club and Professor Erickson as well.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/sasc.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Up next, we have a weather update brought to you by Ime from the Storm Club.
Well, it seems like we'll have fair weather with very variable cloudiness early this week and getting some precipitation later this week with cold front approaching. Here's your weekday forecast for UBC. Monday night, a few clouds, fog patches overnight, low of 6. Tuesday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 15. Wednesday, cloudy, low of 9, high of 13. Thursday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of 7 and high of 12. Friday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 6, high of 12. Saturday, cloudy with 60% chance of shower again, low of 7 and high of 13. Currently, it's 11 degrees and mostly cloudy at UBC. The normal temperature for this time of year are a maximum of 13 Celsius, a minimum of 6 Celsius. That's the weather for this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Ime Lee.
That was the weather update for this week. Thank you to the Storm Club. Up next, we have a live in-studio discussion with Professor or Dr. Chris Erickson, who is a sessional lecturer here at the Political Science Department here at UBC. Welcome to News 101.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, we like to start off our conversation by talking a bit about the Occupy movement spreading across the world. And so tell us a bit about what you thought of the movement when you first heard about it and when you first heard about the arrests in New York City, for example.
Yeah, it's a very interesting movement, and I've kind of been watching it for a little while, and I see sort of it tracing its roots back to, you know, the events of Eastern Europe in the late 80s, early 90s.
Right.
You then have other obvious recent connections with the Arab Spring, And there's an interesting Vancouver connection that I was reading about where the Adbusters group that is sort of based in town.
I heard about that a week ago and I was very surprised.
Yeah, essentially came up with the idea and then it sort of ran from there. It's pretty interesting. I've been watching a lot of the rhetoric that's going on around it. And what I find really interesting about the movement itself is that I almost have to set the stage for this. We're living in a society that's really used to thinking in terms of what the psychologists might call thought-killing cliches.
That's true.
You know, the question primarily is, you know, are you red or are you blue? And, are you with me? Are you against me? Fill in the blanks, right?
Sure.
The thing is, with that kind of an approach, it doesn't leave any room for debate anywhere. If you're with me, well, then there's no need to talk because you're with me. And if you're against me, well, there's no need to talk because you're against me. And what I see with this movement right now is that because it's not conducive to being jammed into those little boxes, you have to treat it differently. And I think that the mass media right now doesn't know how to deal with it. That's why I think it's receiving really comparatively little coverage, because it doesn't fit nicely into the little boxes. It seems to me that really the only way that you can deal with this movement at the moment is to ask yourself, you have to ask the question, what are you all about?
Exactly. And one of the things that the media has been struggling with is the idea of what the message is behind these movements. I mean, if you look at Fox News, for example, mm-hmm. and things like, say, CNBC, they've been struggling about how to label these movements.
Yes.
And how to identify the message. But we've been talking about the idea of the message on News 101 for 2 weeks now, and we've recognized that the situation that we're dealing with is so complex that to bring it down to a couple of messages is practically impossible.
It is practically impossible. Not only is it practically impossible, I think it's unadvisable.
Absolutely.
As soon as, again, I think that I actually heard one of the speakers in New York mention that this is about reclaiming democracy. And it seems to me that as soon as you force it into those little boxes, you know, red or blue, with us or against us, the debate is done, and therefore the need for a democratic forum is done. I think the movement is best served by not producing this list of demands that groups like Fox News and a variety of, not just Fox News, but a variety of others are doing. It strikes me that this is something that you see in the movement itself, not necessarily in the individual participants in the movement. What you have with the individual people that are involved is probably a very wide variety of, hey, you're red or you're blue, but they sit right next to each other. And what you get when you look at it in a larger picture is, one, you're with me or you're against me, right next to another, you're with me or you're against me, right next to another, you're with me or against me. And all of them are absolutely insisting that their way is absolutely right. But again, when you look at it from some distance, the question that emerges is, what kind of world is this that we're living in that you can say all of those things about it, none of which are compatible, and all of which are valid?
That's true.
I think that the one thing that you can surmise about the world is that it doesn't fit nicely into these red or blue boxes.
Absolutely. And I can't help but think that when you talk about red or blue, I'm thinking about Republicans and the Democrats.
I'm doing that on purpose, yes.
Yes. And when you hear what the Republicans have to say about this movement, and when you compare that with what they have to say about the Tea Party movement, the contrast is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how they don't see the similarities between the two movements.
It's very true. I actually think that the Tea Party gives a pretty good example of what the Occupy movement should not do. The Tea Party very quickly bounced into these you're with us or you're against us categories.
Right.
And as soon as it did that, you look at the recent support numbers for the Tea Party, they're way down, simply because that debate, that time for talking about what it's about, is now past, because they've forced themselves into that box. Again, they've terminated the debate when they were trying to open it up. And I think that the Occupy movement at its best will quite literally persist, so long as they don't have to put forward a list of demands. They simply have to not go away. and I think that that is the reclamation of democracy. When you look at, I mean, we talk about how the Republicans are responding to it, but at the same time, when you have Obama saying, well, you know, I understand what these concerns are all about, but, oh, by the way, financial sector, I've got your back.
Absolutely. His response is quite meager as well.
Yes. Bleak. Yes. And it speaks to another thing that I think in general the movement seems to be getting at is the failure of what we are calling democracy to actually address any of these questions.
Right.
and I think that that's why it needs to stay open. What we are considering to be democracy is not what we've got at the moment, and I think the movement highlights that. The tricky part is how do you go about changing it? Because obviously the systems in place aren't working, and so using them isn't going to work either. And that poses some real pragmatic and practical questions of, you know, how do you make this stick? How do you make these changes meaningful?
Yeah, practical questions about how democracy has changed in modern times. I mean, talking about the idea of representation within politics and how people in the Occupy movement are generally frustrated about the way they are represented in the political system. Yeah. And what do you have to say about the idea of misrepresentation and the idea that the people that we've apparently voted for do not believe in the things we believe in?
Yeah, I think that again, that makes people very angry.
Absolutely.
When you're voting for somebody that you think is going to do a certain thing and they end up doing something quite different, that's obviously extremely frustrating, especially when they control all of the avenues for redressing that.
Right. And it shows itself in the disappointment with Obama, too.
I think so as well. I mean, it really does. I think the important thing is, again, not to pigeonhole all of this. You know, who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Yeah. We're very comfortable in thinking in those terms, but as soon as we do that, we miss out. We really miss out.
But I was just going to say, while I was at Occupy Vancouver, there was a lot of people speaking, a lot of different people speaking, and some people who were speaking, just because they were allowed to speak, like anybody was allowed to speak, it made some people who were not legitimate go up, and then it was just like, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much... I don't know, there was like a random guy talking about something random, and...
Well, first of all, none of them are random. They're all issues that everybody is concerned about. It's just that the problem with speaking out like that is that the main issues get sidetracked. Like, for example, we were at Occupy Vancouver, and we noticed, frankly, people that were there but shouldn't have been there at that particular time. For example, people who were talking about the truth about 9/11, quote unquote,
absolutely,
or about the issues around Palestine and Israel. I mean, these are great issues to talk about, but not at this venue.
Well, I think the question then becomes who decides that agenda, and
that
in a democratic society, we expect that agenda to be decided for us. Well, what's your main point, and that's what we'll talk about. This goes back to the whole concept of reconceptualizing our democracy. Perhaps one thing that a democracy isn't is efficient. But that's okay, because to be perfectly honest, we're living in a world that is not overly conducive to being treated efficiently. And when we try to treat it efficiently, we always invariably leave out too much stuff that could matter. And I think that, yes, of course, you're going to have voices that you're like, what in the heck was that? Yes, that's going to happen. But that's the nature of open public debate. I think that the people listening are all going to be able, at least at some level, sort of like the world is looking at the Occupy movement, and they can tell, it's a movement of some kind. I think it kind of works that same way in public debate. Well, these are the main issues that we're talking about. And of course, there's going to be a few outlying ideas, but that's the nature of the debate, and so it's just different things that you get used to,
but,
I would expect.
But then I think the question is then how do you change things? Because if you have so many things that you're talking about, you need to make it specific in order to be able to address the specific problem. Because
do you have a to-do list and go from the top to the bottom, or do you have multiple committees working at the same time?
But that's an extremely difficult question, and I honestly can't give an answer to it. What I can say is that I think that what's most important about the Occupy movement is a change in mindset that needs to happen. And the mindset, you know, we were talking about, you know, are you red or are you blue? Perhaps it's a very subtle distinction that needs to happen. It's not you're red or you're blue, you're with me or you're against me. Perhaps it's you're red or you're blue, I think. You're with me or against me, I think.
Right.
But just that tiny little qualifier is enough to say, I better keep my ears open in case I'm missing something important. And I think that, to a large extent, is what the 99%ers are about. Hey, wait a minute, you've missed 99% of us, and that's kind of important. So it seems to me that a lot of the pragmatic stuff is going to be worked out in a variety of ways. It's just whatever solution we come up with, I think we really need to avoid taking the tack that this is the only solution and anything else is a disaster. I think we really need to avoid taking that tack, whatever else comes out of it. And I think the people say, well, that hasn't accomplished anything. Well, how much airtime and how much debate has it generated? And I would say that, yeah, it's accomplished a lot already, because, again, when you're sort of socialized to thinking things fit in a nice little category, there's no need for the two sides to talk, and there can only ever be two sides, of course, none of this fits. And so it's really disturbing, and it's really troubling, and we're really struggling to try and figure out ways to deal with it. And yet it's that struggle that's the point.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's that active self-conscious, what is this actually all about?
And I think we're used to being like, okay, there's a problem and here's a solution. But I think this is going to take a lot of Occupy movements to just say their problems for a while in order for things to just start to maybe think of solutions. And people aren't used to waiting.
Yeah.
People are used to saying, okay, what's going to happen? Like, is there anything that's going to fix this? And that's what's so crazy about it. It's not like
but
that.
I think, Professor, what you're getting at is the idea that the debate that this movement has generated has not existed prior to this.
Yes.
People have not been talking about these issues, mainly because, first of all, there's a lack of transparency within the political and financial system.
Absolutely.
And that has hindered debate to begin with.
Quite deliberately, I think.
Absolutely.
The tricky part with talking about this stuff is that because of the way these issues have been framed, you really run the risk almost, and it's almost built into the system itself, that as soon as you offer a criticism, you are a conspiracist.
Absolutely. It's ridiculous.
Which is absurd.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a conspiracy that profit-making entities are going to make profits.
Yeah.
It's not a conspiracy at all.
Absolutely. I mean, the purpose of a corporation is to get money from selling products.
And so if they can manipulate financial and political systems to do that, to maximize profits, then why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's logical. It makes sense.
Yeah.
The question then becomes a normative question. Is that right? And those are the kinds of debates that until the Occupy movement really took center stage, we didn't even have the framework to ask that.
Exactly.
I mean, we didn't even have the framework to ask it. And so what the Occupy movement has done is given us a different context within which things that should have been questions now can be questions. And again, that's, I think, what the benefit of it is.
Well, while I was there, I just kind of noticed it's almost like every big demonstration like this kind of becomes cool, and so people start to go not because they know what's happening, but just because they want to be part of it. And I remember, CJ, you and I were there, and you kind of questioned the 99%, like what that means exactly, and if that's really a statistic. And you have all these people throwing out 99%, and they don't even know what they're saying at this point.
I was simply questioning where that number came from, and because I'm doing this story, I haven't really looked up where that number's from.
Yeah, to be perfectly honest, I'm not certain either, except for the rhetoric of the top 1% owning, you know, X number percent of the wealth.
That's what I was about to say. They came from the top 1% owning the majority of wealth in the United States.
Right.
So saying that even though they are 99%, just the way they're not getting the benefits of the system, they don't have the power either. That's from the 1%.
It's also a bit of a play on the Tea Party rhetoric of the 53%, which is basically saying, you know, 47% of Americans don't pay any taxes, which is the rhetoric of the Tea Party. It's a very convoluted way of actually coming up with that number. But the idea is that we are part of the 53%. And the Occupy movement, I think, fairly intelligently kind of one-upped that and said, well, we're the 99%. It sort of rhetorical strategies more than anything else. But I mean, the interesting thing about taking that terminology of the 99 is you don't really want to be left out.
Absolutely.
and so it's, I mean, nobody does. I mean, that's just sort of a feature of social psychology, I suppose.
But what about those people who are part of the 1% and are sympathetic to the 99%?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do they stay in their team, so to speak?
That's a tricky question.
People like Warren Buffett, I mean, he's been outspoken about the Obama administration taxing him.
Mm-hmm.
And that administration did come up with a plan called the Buffett budget, was it? The Buffett principle?
Yes.
A proposal, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We look it up and get back to you on that. But
the Buffett rule.
But yeah, So the idea is that there are people within the 1% who are sympathetic to this.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I think that's always the case. Again, it goes back to this placing things into these overly simplistic binary categories.
Exactly.
And they never work. I mean, realistically, if you look at well, the whole history of ideas, every time you say this is absolutely it, guaranteed the next guy comes along and says, no, you're wrong, this one's absolutely it.
True.
And you end up with a big collection of these things over time. And
you see it with political parties, you see it with ideologies,
oh, yes,
with capitalism,
absolutely.
Communism, for example.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you start placing all of these ideas into a single place at a single time, these counterpositions, these juxtapositions become really apparent. And you sort of stop and say, well, what the heck is going on? and I think there's real value in the ability to question just that. I think that's very, very valuable.
So I have something that I've been thinking about regarding these movements, and it's to do with the idea of simplifying politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of, consider our political system. Think about our political system right now. Is the reason behind these movements because our political system is too complicated? Is this movement calling attention to the fact that we need to simplify a political system? We need to simplify rules. We need to simplify legislation. Is that something that people are concerned about? Do you think underlying this entire financial thing?
I think that insofar as you equate simplicity with transparency, yes.
True.
At the same time, insofar as you equate simplicity with which side are you on? No. I mean, even the term simplicity is not overly simple.
Absolutely,
in this case. And so I think that it's a call for accountability, it's a call for transparency, but what do those things mean? Well, that's open to debate. It's a call for let's take a look and see what kind of voices have been left out of the debate, or the lack of debate, as I should place it. I mean, because really, right now, it's kind of two camps, and there's not much in the way of debate going on between them. Again, I'm citing more... I would say more American examples in this case. The Canadian system seems to have taken maybe some of the sharpest edges off, even though the divide between rich and poor is growing faster in Canada than it is in the United States.
Right.
So I think that a lot of this is speaking to sort of it's employing American styled rhetoric, and I think it's responding to a situation that, you know, when you have the United States, which is still a global superpower, that rhetoric really does come to the forefront, so you really can't ignore it. Even though in different places it's going to obviously, the details of the exact situation are going to be changing. So I think in terms of looking for transparency, yes, they want it simpler. In terms of looking for, we just need a simple framework, you know, are you with us or are you against us? No, I don't think that that's it.
So I guess what I meant by simplifying it is the idea of implementing direct democracy, maybe through mass public infrastructure, mm-hmm. maybe through technology. I mean, even the internet, for example, is one of the best means to vote on something.
Yeah, subject to a variety of pitfalls and problems.
True,
You know, if you've ever played online games, you know how quickly they get hacked. So I can't imagine that the voting system would be an exception to that.
but what I'm saying is there is a possibility for our entire system to move towards something that's accessible to everybody, where everybody has a say in something that they want to talk about.
Yes, I tend to agree that we do have the technological means to do that now. I find it very interesting that at the same time as we have those technological means to do that, especially given events in Vancouver and in London and a variety of other places, events in Germany, for example, you have a move to regulate things like Twitter and Blackberries and texting and all that kind of stuff. Precisely, this is where the state is looking to intervene at exactly the same point that is offering an opportunity for change. And that's an overused word, I know, but an opportunity for things to at least be different. Like, that's the technological means, and I think that. More than just one side is aware of that. And so that's why it would be subject to regulation or subject to some question about should it be regulated.
So So my director here has a question about the Occupy movement. So he says, will the Occupy Wall Street people vote, or are they that disenfranchised by the system? I mean, will they exercise their right to vote?
Yeah.
I can explain this a little bit.
Sure.
Just because when I look at this Occupy movement, I see young people, mm-hmm. you know, 18 through 30-year-olds. I mean, that's not everyone, but mm-hmm. it's kind of the median. You see the internet generation. Well, at the same time with the Tea Party, you saw older people.
Yes.
And it's kind of almost, you know, almost a rule of thumb that you learn in the United States is that old people always vote, but young people don't. So yeah. These people who are so, you know, angry with the system, do you feel that they're so angry that they won't try to fix it in almost the most constructive way they can?
I don't think that the supporters of this particular movement would be opposed to fixing things in the most constructive way possible. I just wonder if they see voting as that most constructive way. As a matter of fact, I would suggest the fact that they've taken to the streets indicates that they don't see it as the most constructive way. And so they're looking, I mean, as to whether or not they're going to vote, you have to ask them, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, in Americans' Republican Democratic system, what are their options to achieve their objective? It's kind of the overthrow of global capitalism is kind of the extreme of one end. You know, mm-hmm, through street mm-hmm. protests, you can, you know, mm-hmm. break in windows to banks, or you can, I mean, I think the best constructive thing that this, if it works in tandem with democracy, that it will bring these issues to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget the presidential election is coming up very mm-hmm. rapidly in the United States. So it'll bring these issues to the forefront and it'll hopefully open up debate in these campaigns about their concerns.
Yeah.
But will people heed their calls if they don't feel like it's a threat to their job? And by them, I mean politicians.
Yeah. The politicians are concerned with keeping power. Once you have it, you don't want to let it go. That's sort of a rule of thumb in politics. And so it wouldn't surprise me if you see, I would say probably more the Democratic Party making use of some of the rhetoric of this. But at the same time, I think that's missing the point of the demonstration itself. I think what the demonstration is pointing to is that the system is broken. And so voting within the system isn't going to help.
I was
going to
say that. I don't think it's about, like, I think these people, it doesn't matter if they vote or not. Like, it obviously does. But I think they're people who did vote and they're still unhappy because no matter what side they vote, it's not fulfilling the needs that they want.
Yeah. I mean, do you vote for the Republicans that are for big business, or you do vote for the Democrats that are for big business?
Yeah.
And I mean, that becomes the issue.
I mean, I feel like with democracy, if they do, that's what I'm trying to say, in tandem, that what mm-hmm. they're doing is important to bring these issues to the forefront. But then, I mean, as we talked about, these are very diverse goals that they have.
Yes.
But when you do want to make that push for your objectives, like, you have to kind of strike fear in the hearts of politicians. You got to, just that 1%, you have to make them listen to you. Because
mm-hmm.
if this divide between power is as great as they say, I mean, it's not like they have to, you know, rely on, like, the good graces of the 1% to do something. But they have to very well make sure that they're listening to them. And how can you hold them accountable through protests? You know, like, there has to be pressure onto them.
Yes. Well, the thing is that how can you hold them accountable through the system that is how they got to where they are in the first place?
And that's kind of where I started, was that, how, like, is a system that majority of us don't participate in, though.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, even with the recent Canadian election, the numbers came out for voter turnout, and they were horrible.
Yeah, they were
embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so I feel like until you, I mean, not become part of the system, but until you use the system as much as you can, and when that fails,
mm-hmm.
the next step is, like, you know.
Well, I think in the case of the Occupy movement, that's a lot of what's motivating it, is that these are the people that have gone through the system. They did get educated. They did do the right thing. They did get out their student loans to go to university so they could get good jobs. Mm-hmm. They did all the right things. They did work for a company for a very long time until they got downsized. You know, they did all the right stuff, mm-hmm. and they're still getting shafted.
Yeah.
And so I think it's come to a point where I wonder if the time for working through the system isn't gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this does not, it's so easy to put a Marxist spin on this, but I'm not sold that this is best understood as a Marxist thing. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily buy that. I think that it's not necessarily, as I see it, a rejection of capitalism. It's a rejection of this kind of capitalism. Yeah.
But I could see him being mixed up with the whole 99% thing as being almost, you know, class consciousness.
Yes, most definitely. Well, curiously enough, you could give the same read to the Tea Party.
Yeah. Maybe different classes.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, I think that I wonder, and I don't have an answer for this at this point. I don't know if anybody does, but I really wonder if the time for working through the system hasn't come to an end. And so what you have to do is work around the system.
Yeah.
And again, that doesn't necessarily mean the doom and gloom apocalyptic scenario of, you know, it's total anarchy and chaos, everything's burning. No, I don't think that that's the case at all. I think that the system that is in place likes to present it in those nice binaries. It's us or it's disaster, right? I don't think it has to be seen that way. And I think that, again, that goes to the point of getting out of these easy little boxes. Mm-hmm. And so to work outside of the system is not necessarily to work outside of any system. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so, yeah, I really don't have a settled answer for, you know, how is this going to change? I don't see it necessarily changing through the system directly.
And just one last thing on my part. I'm sure CJ has a few questions before we wrap up. But going back to the whole 99% versus 1% thing, I forget who was telling me this, but someone was mentioning to me that if you do look at the world in these 99% and 1% things, of course you'll stay away from the binary of it.
Mm.
But, like, almost where does it end? Because you can see people living in the United States as the international 1%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, like, and with this movement going, you know, similar movements in Europe or Canada, doesn't this almost go to, like, almost a global level of we are maybe not the 1%, but maybe the 0.99% against the 0.01%, and then it kind of expands to this, like where does it end of dividing people like this? It's more just a thought than a question.
I get what you mean,
No, you're right, and that's the hazard of the sort of the binary framework, is that it divides infinitely. And it never stops.
Mm-hmm.
And what you end up with is a society that is entirely scattered and alienated from each other. And rather than looking around and saying, hey, wait a minute, that guy's in the same boat as I am.
Yeah.
You know, these people over here are struggling as much as I am. Okay, maybe I have a little, you know, maybe I have more that's available to me than say, somebody in the third world. But again, it's that you can sort of, they're in their boat for the same reason that I'm in my boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe there's a point of connection there that could be addressed. And again, it's about reopening that dialogue and discourse.
Well, Dr. Erickson, thank you so much on behalf of everybody here at News 101. And we'd love to have you back here, you know, to have more discussions like this.
Yeah, anytime.
That's part of our future right now. We've been thinking about having more people involved with debates like this.
I think it's what we need right now.
Absolutely.
The more debate, the better.
Great. Well, that's our program for October 17, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us at any time. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Krigia. And Iqbal is here as well as Martin.
Today's show was produced by everybody, in fact. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
Sore Throats and Clapping Hands
at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...